Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you're the type that keeps track of celebrity couples in popular culture, it's possible you've heard the terms Kimye or Brangelina before. To others less interested in Kim Kardashian or Brad Pitt, you may be a little lost, but these sounds, you know, these may just sound like gibberish words, but this blending actually is associated with a grammatical term. I think it's pronounced portmanteau. Joining us now to talk about that and more is Mignon Fogarty, of course, creator of the award-winning Grammar Girl podcast series and author of several books on grammar, style, and writing. Welcome back to the show, Mignon.
I am. Thanks for having me.
Did I pronounce portmanteau correctly?
I believe you did. A portmanteau is also known as a blend, and it's when you take two words and combine them together, and especially people who write or broadcast about pop culture seem to just love these words. So you brought up Brangelina, which, you know, the media did when Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie started dating. They combined their names to imply that they're one thing. If you're not so into pop culture, one of my favorite blends is spork. It's a spoon plus fork, the little plastic thing. You know, I think we used to get them at Kentucky Fried Chicken when I was a kid, and that's a portmanteau too.
So that's a real thing. Does it make it grammatically correct to use it?
Sure. Okay. I mean, we can, you know, we make up words all the time. English is always bringing new words into the fold, and we can bring them in from foreign languages, or we can just make them up, and sometimes they stick, like spork. Another one is smog. It's a combination of smoke and fog. A lot of people don't know that one. And then I discovered last year when it's broasted chicken. It's a combination of broiled and roasted chicken. And I think it's a trademark. I think there's a special appliance that broasts your chicken. And I saw it in a restaurant and took a picture of the tag and posted it to my Twitter account. And people said, oh, yeah, I've had that. It's great. So sometimes, you know, they're specific to a region or a certain industry. And sometimes they make it all the way into, you know, everyone's vocabulary, like smog.
And spork. We've all heard of spork. I hate sporks, as a matter of fact. Question for listeners. If you have a question for Mignon Fogarty, you want to talk grammar, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to the Facebook page and post your question or comment there. You can also tweet us at WOSU All Sides. Let's see how grammatical you can keep it, even though it's just 140 characters. Mignon, we've been talking about Twitter and Facebook since we first started talking 3 years ago now.
Right.
Have people gotten any better at it, or is it really just becoming ingrained now to shorten things to numerals instead of words, for instance?
You know, I don't see a lot of it. But the thing that I think a lot of people don't understand about Twitter and Facebook is that it's different depending on who you follow. So, you know, I tend to follow a lot of writers and publishing people and reporters, and I tend to follow people who, just because of the nature of their profession, are more careful with their language. And if you're following, you know, all your daughter's 12-year-old friends on Twitter or Facebook, you're going to have an entirely different experience than I do. And I actually think, we're a little off track, but it's something that's always frustrating to me when I talk to people about Twitter, because they'll say, oh, I just don't get it, and people are just tweeting about their lunch or their cat. And it just depends entirely mm-hmm. on who you follow.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Last Wednesday, you tweeted about the MLA coming up with a standard format for citing a tweet. What is the MLA?
Well, the MLA, it's the Modern Language Association style book. And yeah, that was astonishingly, I think it was my most retweeted tweet ever. It was off the charts. People were so excited that the Modern Language Association had come up with a format to properly cite a tweet in an academic paper. And then that started a discussion about whether it's ever appropriate to cite a tweet in an academic paper. And some, you know, professors and teachers were up in arms saying, I would never allow my students to cite a tweet. That's just not an authoritative source. But if you think about it, academics study all kinds of things. They might study, you know, like you were just talking about war in Vietnam, mm-hmm. but they might also study pop culture or celebrity or even social media. So if you're writing an academic paper about Twitter, maybe you're going to need to cite a tweet, and that would be an authoritative thing that you would want to include. So I think it's very useful that the MLA has come up with a format.
I think that the example that I've read is the guy who was tweeting when the helicopter was hovering above Abbottabad, and, you know, of course, to it was just before they landed and found Osama bin Laden, and that would be very historical.
Right, exactly. There are all sorts of interesting, important, timely, newsworthy things that you might see on Twitter. Now, the funny thing that that I read is that the way you cite a tweet, all the things you have to include, might actually be longer than the tweet itself.
Right.
That seemed funny.
Last name, first name, username, the tweet in its entirety, date, time, tweet. Yeah, that's a lot of information.
Yeah.
614-292-8513 if you want to give us a call and join the conversation with Mignon Fogarty. Ghost words, words that come into existence by accident. Tell us about some of those.
Yeah, that was, I did that episode for Halloween because it seemed so fitting, and it was one of the more popular shows I've done. And the first one I talked about was gravy. So these are words that really they, you know, we talked before about how people make up words by blends or things like that. Well, these are words that came about from a mistake. So in Old French, gravy was, I think it was spelled grainy, G-R-A-N-E. And language experts think that when people were translating these old French cookbooks into English, they made a scribal error, that they just transcribed, the scribes wrote a V when they meant to write an N. And then it just got propagated through all these cookbooks. So it went from the French grainy, G-R-A-N-E, to the English gravy. And it's just because a scribe made an error when transcribing the word.
614-292-8513 once again. You wrote a book last year called 101 Misused Words You'll Never Confuse Again after noticing that people were asking you the same questions again and again. And those persist, right? You still write about things like that.
Sure. In fact, just 15 minutes ago on Twitter, I answered a question that I get all the time, which is it an hour or a hour? Because a lot of people were taught that it's the first letter of the word that determines whether you use a or an. So a lot of people were taught that if it starts with a consonant, you use a, and if it starts with a vowel, you use an. But the real rule is that if it starts with a consonant sound, you use A, and if it starts with a vowel sound, you use an. It's the sound, not the letter, that guides whether you choose A or an. So because hour starts with an O sound, it's actually an hour. And a lot of people just get really confused when they're when they have to deal with words like that. Another one is that comes up a lot is MBA. You know, if you say he got an MBA, it's an, because MBA starts with an E sound. It's MBA.
So, oh, okay.
Yeah. Hmm. And a lot of people were taught that wrong for some reason.
Gerald in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hello. I have a question on the use of the word need as a verb. If somebody says they need money, you could say, how much money do they need? Now I'm hearing more and more people saying things like it needs fixed. And I think, well, how much fixed does it need? Shouldn't it be need fixing or need to be fixed?
Oh, that is an interesting regionalism. And people always love to talk about regionalism. So I believe it's in the Ohio area, but correct me if I'm wrong, people will say their car needs washed instead of their car needs to be washed.
Right.
Yeah, and it's a regional thing. People in your area think it's completely standard. I've met copy editors who think that's the proper way to write things. You know, they've gone all through, you know, degrees in English and copy editing training. And people in other parts of the country think it sounds terribly wrong. But you can, if you live your whole life in Ohio, you might not even know that other people think that sounds strange.
Is that along the same lines as went missing?
Well, went missing is different, actually.
Okay.
It's really similar, but it's different. So I believe language experts think went missing came from Britain. So there was a little girl who went missing in Britain, and it was like a huge, huge, you know, 24/7 news story, and one of the first ones from Britain. And over there, they say she had gone missing. She went missing. And then American newscasters started picking up that phrase when they picked up the British story. I think this is mm-hmm. the case. I'm not 100% sure. It might be folk etymology, but this is what I remember. So, and if you think about, like, a lot of people just hate gone missing or went missing, but it does have some parallels in more established American English. So think about if you say you're, say you elected a new senator and you had big hopes for him being independent and he went to Washington and just became like all the rest of them. You might say, oh, he went to Washington and he went native.
Hmm.
You know, okay. That's the same kind of construction as went missing. And we can say the milk went bad. That's sort of the same as saying the person went missing. You can say jobs go begging. That's sort of the same as she's gone missing. So there are some parallels. You know, people will say like, you know, she didn't take action when she went missing implies that she took some action to go missing and maybe she was kidnapped, but milk can go bad without taking any action on its own either. So there are more parallels than a lot of people realize.
All right, Gerald, thanks a lot for your call.
Okay, thank
take
you.
Take care.
Bye.
Speaking of British speaking, we have an email from Robert. He says, I often listen to the BBC news programs on WOSU. I have noticed that the British often leave out the article the before a noun that refers to a specific thing. For instance, I have heard them say she went to hospital, whereas we normally would say she went to the hospital. However, a couple of times recently, I've heard U.S. citizens on NPR leave out the before a noun that designates a specific thing. Should I be surprised when I hear British leave out the like this?
No. In fact, when I thought the example he was going to use was hospital, it's a very typical one where the British will leave out the. I'll say I'm going to hospital. You know, in America, we'll say I'm going to the hospital. It is interesting. You know, this is just a theory, but as we become more international, you know, because we can read the BBC news site or listen to the radio online more easily, I think there's more blending of the languages because we're exposed more mm-hmm. than we used to be to how the British talk. And some people will pick up those ways of speaking, you know, either subconsciously or as an affectation. So I think there's more cross-pollination with language than maybe there was 20 or 30 years ago.
My guest is Mignon Fogarty, creator of the award-winning Grammar Girl podcast series and the author of several books on grammar, style, and writing. If you have a question or comment for Mignon, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Grater's Ice Cream. For over 140 years, the Grater family has handmade ice cream in small batches using natural ingredients. Grater's new black cherry chocolate chip ice cream and other signature flavors are available at 10 neighborhood locations and grocery stores. More information at graters.com.
This is 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, bringing you local and national news 24/7 and always streaming at WOSU.org. Sustaining givers are the future of 89.7 NPR News. A sustainer gives a fixed amount each month. For example, $5, $10, or even $20 per month can be charged to your credit card, and then your membership is always active. Your WOSU member card renews automatically, and we can send less mail reminding you it's time to give. Visit us at wosu.org/sustainer and sign up today. Thank you for your support of 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. My guest this hour is Mignon Fogarty, creator of the award-winning Grammar Girl podcast series. If you have a question about grammar for Mignon, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Don Mignon. He writes, my question is about the use of they when it would seem a singular case pronoun is called for. Consider this sentence. Everyone needs to show their driver's license at the door. Everyone is a singular pronoun. We wouldn't say everyone are invited. For example, instead of everyone is invited, a few decades ago it was proper to use his as a quasi-gender-neutral pronoun, as in everyone needs to show his driver's license. For a short while, we were advised to say everyone needs to show his or her driver's license. Now we hear and read the use of they and their in such instances. Is they now accepted in formal usage for such situations?
Well, it's a fascinating question. Mm-hmm. It's becoming more accepted, and there's actually a longer history for it than most people realize. Jane Austen, for example, used they as a singular pronoun in some of her books. I think I've seen quotes where she has something very similar to what he wrote. Everyone should bring their dresses to the party, right? You know, I don't remember what the quote was, but something like that, the quotation. And it's caused by this problem that English doesn't have a pronoun to use in a situation, particularly when you don't know whether you're talking about a man or a woman. Mm-hmm. So, you could say, tell the next caller he or she won a car, you know, but that sounds so stilted to say he or she. And the person emailing is right that, you know, 30, 40 years ago, it was fine to say he. Everyone accepted he as a gender-neutral pronoun, but that's changed, and none of the major style guides allow that anymore. They all consider that sexist language and say to avoid it, which leaves us with this problem. We don't have a pronoun we can use. So in speech, very often, you'll hear people use they, and I think they don't even realize they're doing it half the time. Now, in writing, you should certainly try to avoid it in formal writing. You know, you wouldn't want to use it in a cover letter for a job or an essay for school or anything like that. You can usually rewrite the sentence to make it plural. You know, if you're saying, instead of saying a student should thank his or her teacher, you can say students should thank their teacher. And you've made it plural, and so it's fine to use they. You know, there are few instances such as the tell the next caller where you really don't know whether the person is male or female, and you can't make it plural. But yes, avoid it in formal writing, but yes, it is becoming more accepted. And I firmly believe in 40 or 50 years, it will be fully accepted and standard and fine in formal writing, just because it fills such a gaping need in the language, and people are already doing it consciously or subconsciously. There are a few style guides that already say it's fine. So I think the language is definitely moving in that direction, but as our language does, it moves slowly, and it leaves this sort of interim squidgy period where it's kind of okay but kind of not, and it upsets some people and other people don't even notice, and that's sort of where it is right now.
Well, it's a bane of your existence, I suppose, the fact that the language is a living language, unlike, say, French, which they have the French language police. We've talked about that before.
Yeah, the French Academy with their immortals, they crack me up. But, you know, and there are people who try to establish such bodies in English, and they always fail because, you know, I don't know, I guess, you know, you could romanticize, you could say, we're Americans, we're wild and free, and nobody's going to rein in our language. You know, it's just, we're just not like that.
Let's see. Don in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Welcome, Don.
Yes, I wanted to add a little bit more clarification to the terminology that you were using there before in a couple of cases, specifically with the term the clothes need washed. That would be a gerundive form. That would be from Scotland. Now, there are two other ways of saying it, the clothes need washing or the clothes need to be washed. The other one is a participial phrase, and, of course, the last one is an infinitive. So I just wanted to add a little specificity. When you say in locality, it's specifically Scotland that the gerundive is a derivative of. And the second part that I wanted to get to, though, was where your personality used the term something like very different than. Now, since than is a term of degree, and when you use different, you're using a separating term, as in different from. I don't know how different from can be the same as different than. And how can grammar people who talk English and teach English enforce the proper way of saying different from instead of letting people say different than.
Sure. Yeah, the caller's right. Actually, the correct way to say it is different from. Maybe I misspoke. It's easy to do. And the way I always tell people to remember that is think of those F's in different, those two F's in the middle of the word different, and that's your clue to remember that the correct word to use with it is from. So different from. And if you think of those F's, it'll help you remember that from is the right word. It was interesting, though, that he brought up the Scots. If you just let me go on for a second. It reminded me. There's, you know, people will often complain about done versus finished. They'll say, oh, you know, if you say, oh, I'm done, they'll say, you know, turkey's done, you're finished. And it's sort of a pet peeve for a lot of people. And I've done some research on that, some reading, and they say the bias against the word done in that scenario is based on prejudice against people of Scots-Irish origin. So it comes from the Scots-Irish. So when those people immigrated, they used done instead of finished. And, you know, because there was prejudice against that group of people, the word became prejudiced against, too. So I thought that was a really interesting sort of root in history.
Thank you, Don, for your call. We appreciate it. Take care. Ruth in Northwest Columbus, welcome.
Thank you. Could you comment on the placement of modifiers, as in, only I went to the store, I only went to the store, I went only to the store, etc.?
Yes. So I will start by saying this is an error I make myself a lot, and so I'm probably more lenient about it than the average person or the average grammar stickler. But the way it's thought of traditionally is that where you put only can change the meaning of the sentence. So you're supposed to put the modifier before the word it modifies. So a classic example is I only have eyes for you means only eyes, because only comes right before eyes. So that's like saying I don't have a nose for you or a heart for you. I only have eyes for you. Supposedly, you're supposed to say I have eyes only for you, and that means nobody but you catches my eye. So it's the word that you put that modifier before can change the meaning of the sentence depending on the word that comes next. And so you can create ambiguities by misplacing that word only, or the same is often true of almost. The example I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, couldn't it be like a phrase, though? Couldn't it be modifying a phrase, eyes for you?
Yeah, it could be. See, it's very ambiguous, and you can put adverbs in lots of different places in sentences, but in certain instances it can change the meaning. Like in my book, the example I use is I almost failed every art class, and I failed almost every art class. You know, and one says you got all D's, and the other one said you passed. You know, you passed 1 out of 9. So, you know, it can change the meaning depending on where you put it. So you do need to be careful with those modifiers.
All right, Ruth, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Take care. Mm-hmm. Here's a classic. Jefferson in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome. Hi, Jefferson.
Hello.
Hi.
So I have a question that I think has to do with a lot of things you've been talking about and the difference between prescriptivism and descriptivism. And so the question is about whom and what you tell people about using whom, because in a descriptive sense, it seems to be sort of falling out of the language. But from a prescriptive sense, we're still required to use it in certain places. So I'm curious what you tell folks when they ask you about that.
Right, yeah. So let me give people some background. So there's this constant struggle between prescriptive grammar and descriptive grammar. So prescriptive, you know, are the people who say you should always use whom in every instance where you're using the object pronoun, or the people who say, you know, that only have eyes for you is wrong. It should be I have eyes only for you. And there are all these rules. And again, like the plural versus singular they that we were just talking about, that's another example. So descriptivists would say it's fine to use they as a singular pronoun. Everyone is already doing it. It fills a void. We need it. It's no problem. And prescriptivists would say, never, never, never. These are rules, and they should be followed. So that's sort of the battle that is always ongoing in English. I try to find a middle ground. So regarding whom, you'll see, I've seen essays where people are saying we should just drop the word altogether. Nobody knows how to use it. It sounds pedantic and overly formal. Let's just not use whom anymore. And then, you know, on this one, personally, I don't, you know, I tend to follow the style guides like the AP Style Book and the Chicago Manual of Style and Garner's Modern American Usage. You know, I consider those the authorities on English, and I tend to follow their lead. And I don't think they're giving up on whom anytime soon. So, you know, I don't think Chicago is going to come out and say, oh, you don't need to use that word anymore. So, you know, again, it's one of those things in 50 or 100 years, it very likely could change, because it's true, nobody knows how to use it. Or not nobody, but, you know, a lot of people struggle. So the way I help people remember is you can test your sentence to see if it needs a who or whom. So because whom is an object pronoun, you can use him as a test case. So if you can hypothetically restate your question as an answer, if you can hypothetically answer your question using him, then whom is the right choice. And you can remember because they both end with the letter M, him and whom both end with M. So the example is, you know, who or whom should we invite to the party? Well, you'd answer, we should invite him to the party. So since you have a him, you know whom is the right choice. If you were saying who or whom is coming to the party, you would say he is coming to the party, not him is coming to the party. So since you don't have a him, then you use who. So you'd say who is coming to the party. So it's the him test. Usually works.
Okay.
Yeah, hey,
Jefferson, thanks a lot for your call. Kevin in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Kevin.
Yes. I have a comment about the way that advertisers seem to be, in trying to be edgy, they're misusing grammar, and I think it's contributing to the decline in proper use of grammar. And a couple of local examples I can give you are the local hospital came out with an ad campaign saying, believe in we instead of believe in us. And also the local cable company has a campaign where they say, enjoy better. So just a comment. I'll go offline and let's talk about it.
Mignon, you were tweeting about a contest about ungrammatical ads.
Oh yeah, that was actually for typos. But,
oh, typos. Okay.
I mean, it's funny because this isn't such a rich mind to attack for language problems. You know, whenever I'm struggling, I do a podcast every week, and whenever I'm struggling for a topic, I'll go look at ads and see what's going on. So, last week I talked about Apple's latest ad. They talk about the new iPod is engineered for maximum funness. And they say they've re-nanoed the iPod. So Apple, you know, has a long history of doing edgy things with language. They had their Think Different campaign, and a few years ago they talked about the funnest iPod ever. Some other ads. There was a cell phone commercial probably 5 years ago now where they kept saying, where are you at? Where are you at? And, you know, where are you at is, you know, a pet peeve. I'm surprised somebody hasn't called to talk about it already.
We usually get wanted. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, ending a sentence with an unnecessary preposition, where are you, means the same thing as where are you at. So you can leave off the at. But, you know, there was that cell phone commercial, and they must have said it 100 times in that commercial. But it goes all the way back to one of the earliest ones I hear people complain about is the cigarette ad. I think it's Winston tastes good like a cigarette should.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, back then the proper way to say it was as a cigarette should, not like, but as. And that caused a lot of people to get upset back, you know, gosh, how many years ago was that? Maybe now 60
I think they
ago?
Were more upset about that than cigarette smoking.
Yeah, back then they sure were. So, it's, you know, in advertisers, their job is to get attention for their product. And, you know, there's no better way. Well, there are better. I guess there are better ways to get attention than mangling the language, but it's one of the common ways to get attention. And one of my favorite comments on this topic, fiction author I follow named Christiana Ellis. She once said, getting upset over errors in marketing language is like getting upset over the finer points of Pig Latin. You know, you're just your expectations just should not be that high.
Exactly. Yeah, you got to get a life, I guess, is another way to put it.
Well, it's just sort of a hopeless battle, too. Right. I mean, I understand why people are upset,
yeah.
But it's just you're never going to win that battle.
Dennis and Marion, you're on the air with Mignon Fogarty.
Hi, Mignon.
Hi.
What a fantastic story or, you know, program. I had a couple of things. Just people always say he ate healthy, and it drives me crazy instead of using an adverb. The other thing was that I read that sometimes heat, extreme heat, the thing that I could never understand is how we develop a southern accent. And it drives me crazy. Where did it come from when we all primarily came from England, you know, it's English? So I read somewhere where the extreme heat created a kind of lazy language that can be translated into slang or into the way the southern accent came about. Could you address that?
Oh, that's interesting. I've never heard that explanation before. Well, you know, this is a question that linguists tend to study, and they'll look at regionalisms. I'm trying to remember because I know that I think I have heard that, you know, the American accent is more like what the British used to be when they came over, that if you look at accent changes over time, we speak more like the Britons did, you know, 200 or 300 years ago. But I'm not certain that's true. That's just something I think I remember hearing. But the thing that, you know, it's really regional isolation that helps form these pockets of language, like the needs washed. You know, you get people in certain regions that start using a language or a pronunciation, and it sort of stays in that area and catches on. I use my Facebook page to do surveys, and I make maps of where people say things, and you know, like spendy is a really common phrase in Portland and the Seattle area.
What's the word?
Spendy. So it means expensive. So, that restaurant is really spendy.
Wow.
And it's very common in the Pacific Northwest. You know, but it's like needs washed. You've never heard it probably. So, and there are Pittsburghese. They have all sorts of funny ways of saying things.
Downtown.
Yeah, in Pittsburgh, and you know, some people will. I'm trying to think of like the median, that grassy median in the center of the street. It has different names in different parts of the country, and so part of it is this regional separation where you just don't hear things people are saying in other areas, and then part of it is sort of identifying with your group. You know, I'm sure. When we were teenagers and when we see teenagers, they have their own language, that their own way of speaking when they're together. And it's a way of saying you're part of our group. We all speak the same way. And I think that has an effect on, you know, keeping regional dialects and accents going too. You know, you want to sound like all your friends. And that just, you know, usually all your friends are in the same region. So, you know, I think it's a really interesting topic, but it's not my area of expertise.
Okay. All right. We are going to take a quick break, and then we'll return to our conversation with Mignon Fogarty, creator of Grammar Girl podcast series. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Watch the story of a 22-year-old son of a sharecropper who triumphed over adversity to become a hero and world champion. Tuesday night on WOSU-TV, American Experience presents Jesse Owens, a program that highlights his stunning triumph at the 1936 Olympic Games. Despite the racial slurs he endured, Owens's grace and athleticism rallied crowds across the globe. Watch American Experience Jesse Owens, Tuesday night at 8 on WOSU-TV.
So So how does Mel Brooks feel about being on Fresh Air?
Public radio. I mean, this is my career. I'm finished. It's over. I'm picking up cigarette butts.
Mel Brooks on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Examine the 68-year history of nuclear weapons Wednesday night on WOSU-TV. Filmed in Europe, Japan, and the U.S., In My Lifetime focuses on the continuing struggle of citizens, scientists, and political leaders to reduce or eliminate the atomic threat, while others search for ways to build the weapons. The film shifts between historical events to present-day efforts to contain the spread of nuclear weapons. Watch In My Lifetime Wednesday night at 10 on WOSU-TV.
Welcome back. We're talking with Mignon Fogarty, creator of the Grammar Girl podcast series and also author of several books on grammar, style, and writing. If you have a question or comment for Mignon, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Mike in Obatz, you're on the air. Welcome, Mike.
Hi. I have a question about the expression, as it were. It kind of goes in my ear crooked because it's both singular and plural. I always think of a substitute expression, so to speak, if I've got it right from context, but maybe that's not even correct. I just, if I'm going to rebel against it, I want to make sure at least that I'm correct.
Mignon.
I'm sorry, I have no idea. I've never heard a question like that before, and I don't use the phrase as it were, and I don't know if I've...
I'm surprised no one's brought that one up before.
Yeah, it is. You know, the I know there are like was versus were. You say if it were when you're used. It's called the subjunctive case, subjunctive mood actually, and you use it for things that are wishful or hypothetical. You know, the classic example is if I were a rich man, mm-hmm. or fiddler on the roof, because he's not. He's just wishing. But yeah, I don't know if that's related to the phrase as it were. Or not. I actually don't know. I'm sorry.
You stumped okay. Mignon Fogarty.
Thank you.
Good job, Mike. Okay.
It happens all the time. And I tell people, you know, if like one of my favorite books, Garner's Modern American Usage, it's almost 900 pages long. Like no one person can know everything about the English language. So, you know, sometimes people will feel bad that they don't know the answer to a question. So don't feel bad. Just look it up.
Thanks a lot, Mike.
Thank you much.
Take care. Bye-bye. Okay, we got this gerunds thing back. Carrie and Hilliard, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. Well, nice to hear this conversation being, I love grammar. There is a usage that is actually common even in newspapers and magazines that drives me crazy, maybe because I really, truly believe in parallel structure. When as well as is used as a conjunction, an example like he hiked in the woods as well as swimming in the river, you come across it much more often than you would like to think, and you have to go back and say, it should be he hiked in the woods and swam in the river.
Yeah. Yeah,
but as well as has become a substitute for and it's wrong. I think.
Right. Yeah. A lot of people think that as well as, and oh, there's some other phrases, but are the same as and, but they're not. They also don't make subjects plural. So if you say, you know, Brittany and Sarah are going to the mall, that's because the and makes Brittany and Sarah plural. But if you use as well as, it stays singular. So you'd say Brittany as well as Sarah is going to the mall, because as well as, it doesn't make it plural in the same way that and does. But I think a more interesting point that the caller brought up is this parallel construction error, because I see this a lot on resumes, and it's just not having parallel structure can make your resume seem disjointed, and the reader may not even know why, but it sort of jumps out. So what you want to do is if you say you have bullet points of things you accomplished in your resume, you want to make sure that they use the same structure, a parallel structure. So if you say, you know, in 2011, I, and you would say, like, helped increase sales made 20 sales, achieved all my goals. All those verbs, so every bullet point starts with a verb, and they're all in the past tense. You don't want to switch between past and present, and you don't want to start some with a verb and some with a noun. You want to keep all those bullet points in parallel structure, and it'll make your resume come off looking, you know, much more professional and organized. So that's like a really common error on resumes, and it, you know, everyone has to write a resume. So stick with that parallel structure, and you'll be better off.
Thank you, Carrie.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
But how do we get people to stop using? And I see it in newspapers more often than any place else. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Email from Carl. He writes, does the nominative case follow the subjunctive mood? First, do you know what he's talking about?
I know. Is he trying to mess me up? Let's see. So, So nominative, I should know this. I believe it's like the subject. When something's in the nominative case, it's the subject case. So that's just saying, like saying, I went to the store. I'm afraid I'm getting this completely wrong.
I know, Carl. I mean, are you asking or is
yeah,
he testing you? Or?
You know, in the subjunctive, that's that whole, I wish I was, you know, wishful, hypothetical thinking. That's when you use the subjunctive mood.
Uh-huh.
Is when it's, you know, you're saying, I'll hear a girl say, I wish I was pregnant, and it's, I wish I were pregnant, because you're not. It's, I wish I were a rich man, not I wish I was a rich
okay.
man.
Okay.
But that's as far as I can go with this question.
Okay. Sorry, but once again, we stumped the grammarian. Let's see. Let's get to a call now. Mako in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, hey, I was, as a young man, I was given Strunk and White's Elements of Style, and I was wondering if that was any kind of a baseline for the Grammar Girl.
Oh, boy. Everyone's trying to get me in trouble here. So Strunk and White is like, beloved. You know, mm-hmm. like everyone loves Strunk and White. I had Strunk and White when I was in school. It's often people's first exposure to a style book, and it's so simple and clear, you know, and short. Everyone loves it. It's not a bad place to start, but it's not comprehensive. You know, I was looking at it, and there's nothing about how to use a question mark, for example, in Strunk and White. It's really missing a lot of basic things that people might need to know.
It seems to be more basic principles about approach to writing.
Right. Well, it's interesting because Strunk and White didn't work on it together. Strunk wrote the first part, which is sort of the rules, and White, who is actually E.B. White, the famous children's author. And
Charlotte's Web, yeah.
An essayist. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he wrote the last half later, which is the style part, the part of the end that everyone particularly loves. And, modern grammarians aren't that in love with Strunk and White as much as the average person is. There's a famous linguist, Pullum, who just rails against Strunk and White. And, for example, he says there are examples of passive voice sentences, like half of them aren't even in passive voice. So, and throughout the book, Strunk and White break their own rules in the book. So there's sort of this movement against Strunk and White, but I know it's like this terribly beloved book. So, you know, to come out and say that is dangerous.
Okay. Mako, thanks a lot for your call. We appreciate it. Take care. Yolanda in Columbus, you're on the air with Mignon Fogarty. Hi, Yolanda.
Hi. I wanted you to speak about the use of the word myself. I hear people say, send the information to myself.
Yes.
I wonder why they say that instead of send the information to me. And I'll take your answer offline so I don't get the echo.
Okay.
Thank you,
Yolanda.
Yes, finally an easy question. Thank you. So for some reason people say, you know, send the memo to myself instead of send the memo to me. And I think it's because it sounds more formal or important, but it's just not correct, you would say. And it happens more often when there are multiple people in the sentence. So even people who might get it right and say, send the memo to me, if you add someone else, they might say, send the memo to Bob and myself. And Bob doesn't change anything. It should still be me, because you're in the object position there. So, you know, if you would say, send the memo to me, which is correct, then you should say, send the memo to Bob and me. But, yeah, people get that wrong all the time. You'll hear it especially in business situations. But me is the correct choice.
An email from Amy in Bexley. She says, I've noticed that the word less has taken over the use of fewer in language usage. Rarely do I hear fewer in cases such as there are fewer people in town today. Rather, I hear there are less people in town today. I believe I learned that fewer is to be used for any nouns you can count, and less is for non-countable nouns or bulk quantity nouns. There is less smog in the air today. I even hear newscasters regularly substitute with less in all cases today. Just curious about this usage change. And I'm with you, Amy. Mignon Fogarty, what do you make of it?
Yeah, she explained it perfectly. Mm-hmm. It's a common error using less when you should use fewer. Fewer is for things you can count, so there were fewer people at the party is correct, and less is for things you can't count, like there's less water in the lake this year. You can't really count the water. So
what about less money?
Oh, money, time, and distance are different because, and this is just my theory, but it's because my theory is that because they're infinitely divisible, that you can't really count them. So, yeah, you would say, we have less money in the bank. I hope they paid the band less than $400 for that appearance. So distance, time, and money sort of don't follow those same rules. But in general, when you're talking about, M&Ms or furniture or things like that, you just ask yourself if you can count it. And if you can count it, you should use fewer.
Judy in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Judy.
Hi. I have a peeve, and I'll just throw it out there to see what Mignon thinks. People have picked up this habit of beginning their sentences with so. Experts, regular people, it doesn't seem to matter. For example, you can be asked a question. Well, what do you think about the changing atmospheric pressure in the United States? And the person responding will say, so the change in the,
noticed that too, Judy, a lot.
I am going crazy.
I think, Mignon, you do that sometimes.
I do, yeah. In fact, my podcast is scripted, because everyone expects the language to be perfect, so I write a script before I do every show, and I'll notice that I will start a sentence with so, and then I'll go back and I'll delete it, because so I even tend to write it into my scripts, and I think it, I don't know why I do it, it sort of gives a sense of continuity from the previous thing that was said, or it's a way of delaying. I think for some people, especially, on the radio when you're doing an interview, mm-hmm. I think it's a way of delaying to give yourself more time. It's like or any other verbal tick.
Sometimes I think when I hear people talk using that phrase, people like you who are answering questions like this, you're thinking in your mind what the answers are going to be, and then you're following, okay, so... And then you dive in and say it. So there's you're thinking, and then you start talking about your thoughts.
Yeah, it's almost as if you're having a conversation with yourself and your brain, and then you're continuing it verbally, but you're really just starting to talk, even though it's halfway over in your brain.
And meanwhile, back at the ranch, you're driving Judy batty.
Sorry.
well, it is. It's widespread. As I said, it doesn't matter. Experts. Regular folk, it really doesn't matter. But I'd sure like to know who started it.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
If anyone wants to take credit for that, give us a call.
Thank you.
Judy, thanks for your call. Email from Beth in Clintonville. She says, one of my greatest pet peeves in grammar is the frequent use of the word most when it should be almost. almost always versus most always, almost everybody versus most everybody, and so on. Now I am seeing it in books and hearing it on the news and wish they would use almost properly. Or has the rule changed?
Gosh, I don't know. It doesn't sound wrong to me. What was the example again?
Almost always versus most always.
Oh, almost always versus most always. Mm-hmm. Yeah, to me that doesn't actually sound wrong, but it just could be because I've heard it so much. I haven't looked it up. It could be a shortened form, or it could just be wrong. I don't know. But I guess this is a great place to sort of wrap up, is that when you have questions like these, often you can find the answer in a dictionary. There are some great online dictionaries. There's Merriam-Webster, Merriam-Webster.com and dictionary.com, and I think the American Heritage Dictionary is online. And, you know, often if you're wondering if something's right or wrong, you can just go look it up and get the answer.
But I think they're asking you for validation.
They're asking me for validation.
I think they have their mind made up, Mignon. But here's the classic email from Lou. How does one determine, as our sign-off today, how does one determine whether to use affect or effect? I always pause when this comes up, and I'm still not sure which is correct. You have a good trick for that, don't you, Mignon?
I do. Okay, well, first I'll say, if you force me to take a stand, I'll say most isn't wrong. But affect versus effect, one of the most common questions people have, and there are exceptions, but most of the time, affect with an A is a verb, and effect with E is a noun. And you can remember that by just thinking of the mnemonic raven. Think of a big black raven flying through the sky, because the word raven has A-V-E-N in it, those letters, and that stands for affect, verb, effect, noun.
Okay, and then real quick, an email from John in Findlay. He says, in the same vein as an hour, I find media use of an historic, possibly the single most irritating misuse of the language extant. If your guest ever meets Brian Williams of NBC, can she please correct him? But if you would get his autograph for me first, Mignon. Okay, an historic, but if you pronounce historic versus historic.
Yes. So because it's based on the pronunciation of the word and not the first letter, and in certain places on the East Coast, they say historic. If it should be an historic, if that's how you say it. Mm-hmm. But in most parts of the country, we say historic with that his sound, that consonant sound at the beginning. So it should be a historic.
And, of course, if Brian Williams is that East Coast type.
Yeah. And generally in writing, like style books say it should be a historic in writing. So, and there are people who vehemently disagree. I had a woman shake her fist at me and walk out of one of my book signings over this point. There are people very, very strongly, but that is what the style books say.
Well, people feel very passionate about this topic. That's why I always love having you on. Thanks for joining us again, Mignon Fogarty.
You're welcome. Thank you, Anne.
Mignon Fogarty is creator of the award-winning Grammar Girl podcast series and the author of several books on grammar, style, and writing. We'll have links to them on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Corinne Gleckler, production assistants Karim Shaban, Rose Joe, and Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsmiski and Amber Karsmiski. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.